Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Stay tuned, a little later in the podcast you can hear my interview with John Croupy, the captain of 45-metre Dorothea 3, which picked up a Voyagers Award, which picked up the Voyagers Award at the most recent World Superyacht Awards. So each year this award goes to a yacht that has done some inspirational passage making, and that was certainly true of Dorothea 3. In fact, inspirational passage making is about all this yacht's done for 20-odd years. They have covered a crazy amount of miles, probably more than any other super out there, really. And what made the latest adventure so amazing is that the big boat cruised in tandem with a smaller 63-foot Sportfisher, which wasn't towed. It undertook these vast Atlantic and Pacific passages under its own power. So John had to devise a way to refuel the Sportfisher from the mothership at sea, and it took them almost two Atlantic crossings to really nail it. Anyway, it's a fascinating insight into the challenges and rewards of a massive big destination cruising, big blue water passage making. And we'll also put a link to the story we wrote about the adventure in the description to the podcast. So after you've heard John speak, why don't you go and read that as well? Talking about exciting interviews, Caroline, I'm very excited about one you've got lined up, or potentially lined up, with Hollywood director Roland Emmerich, who owns a beautiful classic boat I've literally just learnt. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, so at the risk of counting our chickens before they've hatched, hopefully speaking to him next week. He's super, super busy filming at the moment, so he's trying to fit us in when he can. But he owns a beautiful classic, American classic motor yacht called Maid Marian II, which charters in Greece. So I think that's his sort of his oasis amid his incredibly stressful job. So I'm looking forward to hearing all about that, and perhaps also what he's working on at the moment in terms of filming.
So he did Independence Day, which was on TV the other day. So the kids and I watched Independence Day, Will Smith's finest work, in my view.
Yeah, exactly. So Roland Emmerich does, he specializes in sort of big blockbuster disaster films. So he also did, I think, White House Down, if you've seen that one more recently, and all that sort of thing. So it might be interesting to see if he's ever considered setting a disaster film on a yacht. I don't know.
Well, fingers crossed that all goes off, because he is filming at the moment. So if you can squeeze Boat International into his busy filming schedule, that'd be brilliant. So stay tuned, listener, and hopefully you'll hear from Roland Emmerich in a couple of weeks. Charlotte, meanwhile, you've been getting green this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly less glamorous than interviewing Hollywood film directors, but very important. I've been catching on all sorts of sustainability things. I did a course last week that was set up by the Water Revolution Foundation. We've mentioned them on the podcast before, but if you've not heard of them, essentially they're the people to go to if you want to know how sustainable your yacht is. So you can take them your boat or your plans and designs for a boat that you're thinking about, and they can give you a really thorough assessment of how sustainable it is from start to finish and show you how you compare to others as well. So anyway, it was just a really interesting mixed group of people. There was everyone from captains of classic yachts, people based out in Ibiza, through to builders, Royal House member in my group, quite a few people from there, sustainability experts from places like paint companies, owners' representatives. So a really interesting mixed group of people, all with quite interesting thoughts.
So what did you learn on the course?
Well, I think the two things I'll take away from it is, firstly, that sustainability doesn't sort of mean eco. I think we tend to think of it as, we want to be more sustainable. What fuels can we use, or how can we use less plastic, and sort of thinking about it in terms of greenness? But really, there's a lot of different boxes that can have to be ticked before you can rightfully claim that something is sustainable. So, for example, the people involved with the project need to be happy and working under good and safe conditions. Or if it's an amazing eco product that you're developing, the market for it has to be there. It has to be profitable, and you have to make sure that you're not just shunting a problem on elsewhere, which seems to be happening a lot at the moment, especially in yachting.
So there's never been anything like this in the superyacht industry before, and they're trying to disrupt, in a good way, I suppose, the entire superyacht life cycle from conception to delivery and then onwards if you buy it and refit it later in its life. So at each of those points, they can audit the greenness or eco-ness effectively of the project.
Yeah, life cycle is an interesting word to use because that's something that came up quite a lot in that lots of people sort of raising, okay, you know, I don't want to name any names, but there are big boat builders claiming to be making eco boats using certain fuels or whatever, but they're also going to be completely indisposable when they come to their end of their life cycle. So that was something that people were talking about a lot, kind of, you know, there's going to be a wave over the next 10 years of a whole load of boats that we can't do anything with. And, you know, who's responsible for those? Who's thinking about that going forwards? And it did sort of reflect the fact they had us look through a number of sustainability reports from different yacht companies. And when you first read these things, you think, oh, that's pretty impressive. You know, they've got various stats and things showing that they're doing good stuff. But it actually really revealed that very few people are kind of setting themselves targets for the future, looking at what they can do, you know, saying in 10 years time, we're going to have done X, Y, Z. There's a lot of kind of stuff on the surface that sounds fairly impressive. But when you look a bit deeper, it's not. But it wasn't all doom and gloom. Like I say, it's easy to be a bit negative about this and to complain about how far behind other industries we are. But it was a really passionate group of people, all with really interesting solutions. And something that came up was basically, you know, lots of these companies are saying we shouldn't be offering owners the choice anymore. We shouldn't be saying to them, do you want this paint, which is very bad for the environment, or this paint, which is good? We should just be cutting out any products that we don't support and kind of forcing the demand by limiting what we're offering. So it'll be interesting to see if owners sort of feel that change in the next 5 years or not.
It's interesting that, because in my conversations with brokers very recently, they're telling me that owners now, when they're looking to buy a brokerage boat, one of the questions they ask is, how environmentally sound or friendly is this boat? And they might not necessarily choose the boat that's the most environmentally friendly, but they're asking the question. And so when brokers, you know, they might go, well, here's five or six that might suit your needs. They now have to think about, rate them effectively on an eco scale. And so the owners, you know, can go for the greenest one. Or not, it's up to them. But they're asking the question. It's the same with charter clients too. They're asking the same question, which is great. And I happen to know that there's going to be the next couple of years, 5 or 6 years, going to be really interesting from a fuel power front. I think there's going to be some massive developments and groundbreaking boats being launched that will change the game for super yacht propulsion, fingers crossed. So yeah, it's a really exciting time to be in the industry, actually.
It's interesting you say about owners, actually, because something that came out of the conversation as well is just how personal it is. Some captains were kind of saying, look, I can't make this decision for my owner. If I choose a more expensive product over a cheaper one, they're going to turn around and say, well, why did you do that? You know, I'm really angry. Whereas other people were saying, I know that my owner is going to completely see the sense that we've taken this path because it's a more sustainable choice. I don't need to ask them. I don't need to okay it. We're just going to make these decisions for them. So it's a tricky path for everyone to navigate, but good that people are looking into it, and hopefully we'll all keep in touch and keep you posted on any interesting developments, like you say.
Yeah. It feels like the momentum's relentless now. It can't be stopped. The kind of the boulder's been pushed down the hill. Let's go. We're on this path. And there's no stopping it now, which is actually really exciting. I think the whole industry is retuning to be a bit more sustainable, which is fantastic.
Well, something else I've been looking at, someone else who's struggling against a seemingly unwinnable war, is a skipper. I've been putting together our Life Under Sail supplement for our issue coming out shortly. And I was sorry to hear if there's a skipper called Norbert Sedley.
Try and say that.
Oh, I'm just going to close my...
Can you skip his middle name?
What?
We're keeping all this in the final edit of the podcast, by the way.
No. Okay, speaking of people who are fighting against a seemingly impossible war, we've got our Life Under Sail supplement coming out shortly. So I've been looking at lots of different bits of sailing news for that. And I was sorry to hear if there's a skipper called Norbert Koch who's got a world record attempt to sail all five oceans solo, non-stop and unassisted, which sounds like the most incredible challenge. But unfortunately, he's got off to a spectacularly unlucky start. The first trip was aborted in summer 2019 when rigging damage put the Northwest Passage out of reach. So that was strike one. Then last summer, COVID obviously put the second attempt to rest. So this July, he's gearing up for the third attempted set off of the Antarctic Lab mission, it's called, which is named after the treacherous polar seas that he's going to be the testing grounds for his yacht, which is, and this is another tongue twister, an innovative yacht open 60 AAL. It's catchy, but it uses no fossil fuels, So very relevant to what we're talking about, and constructed in fully recyclable volcanic fibre balsa core. So anyway, sounds like a very exciting yacht, but good luck to him. Third time, it must be incredibly difficult gearing up for these things. Fingers crossed for him.
I've never met a Norbert.
It's a great adventurer's name, isn't it, Norbert?
It's not, no, it's a terrible adventurer's name. But he is. But what a guy! He's doing some amazing things. So good luck to Norbert on his third effort.
But of course, all that news sort of pales into comparison in terms of what we've all been discussing this week, which is what's going on with Perini Navi. Obviously, everyone in the industry is talking about that. We've been sort of tracking the story and updating it live as new bits and pieces come out. But I guess, does one of you want to sort of summarise where we're at now in case I'm not up to date?
Sure. Well, to sum it up, really, Perini Navi was declared bankrupt by an Italian court last week. So last year, the brand announced that it had reached an agreement with the private equity company Blue Sky Investment Group to restructure its 100 million euro debt. The court in Lucca gave the company until this year to present the final restructuring plan, but it's understood that none was forthcoming, which led the court to declare the shipyard bankrupt. So this week, we've had a few updates on the situation. Palumbo has become the latest superyacht builder to openly declare its interest in the assets of Perini Navi. And that comes after the Ferretti Group, San Lorenzo and the Italian Sea Group all declared their interests in acquiring Perini Navi's assets.
So as you can probably tell, there is so much more to this story. Much of it off the record that we can't report. But we do have our very own... investigative journalist Marilyn Moa is on the case, and so she's been talking to all the big players in this saga, and I've asked her to put together a kind of a what's going on, slightly more fulsome what's going on update with this developing story. But obviously incredibly sad news that Perini Navi has been declared bankrupt, but it came as an awful big surprise to some of the players over at Perini. But yeah, I can't say much more, but hopefully we'll have some on the record comment for you very, very soon.
So what happens to the few people that have Perini boats in build at the moment then? Are they just on ice until something happens?
Well, if presumably one of these other Italian builders, so we know Palumbo, Ferretti Group and San Lorenzo have each expressed an interest in acquiring the assets. Presumably that would mean the in-build projects as well. So if they picked up the brand and the intellectual property and these in-build projects, they would complete them. But that is one of the questions I've asked Marilyn to look into, because there are a number of boats in build there, including a large motor yacht that we've got to find out what's happening with that yacht. So fingers crossed we'll know more soon, and we'll bring that to you over at boatinternational.com.
So in other bad news, just to get all the bad news out of the way in one go, the 2021 St. Bart's Bucket, which was due to take place in March, has been cancelled. It's the second consecutive edition of the event to be cancelled due to the coronavirus, and it sounds like the decision was taken due to the hesitancy of owners. Organisers said the following. One by one, over the last few weeks, yacht owners decided that it had become impossible to attend the bucket in 2021. And they would postpone the participation until 2022. With a committed field of less than five, the collective decision of the race participants had to be acknowledged and accepted by the bucket stewards. As a result, the 2021 St. Bart's Bucket is now officially cancelled.
I love the fact that you call them bucket stewards.
I know. I was going to say that. I love the bucket stewards.
We're keeping that as well. I'm a big fan of the bucket stewards. But actually, one of the bucket stewards is Perini Navi, linking to our previous story. So how that will play out in the future ownership of the bucket, I suppose we'll find out. But yeah, again, you know, not great news there. I was hesitantly, inquiring with our travel agent, our corporate travel agent, about if I did go to the bucket, how would I get to the bucket? But that decision's been made for me. No bucket for 2021. We'll see you all in 2022, fingers crossed.
Very sad. Well, in slightly brighter news, the Dutch yard Moonen is preparing to begin construction on the first 33-metre Moonen 110 motor yacht. It was developed and designed by René van der Velden with naval architecture from Diana Yacht Design. And the Moonen 110 came about after Moonen consulted current and prospective Moonen owners, so should have some good owner input there. She's described as a gentleman's yacht, and while there's a definite resemblance to the Moonen 84 and 97 models, there's also a hint of classic style to her lines, although that might just be me. Another important feature is a shallow draft, which will allow the Moonen 110 to access remote locations, including the Bahamas, Caribbean and Great Barrier Reef. The engineering of the model is now underway ahead of the yacht beginning construction in June. Currently available for sale, the yacht will be due for delivery in 2023.
Happy for Moonen. Good to see Moonen on a roll. They built some lovely, lovely boats.
Absolutely. So sticking to the Netherlands and a rather larger boat, the 76.5-metre Fed ship Boardwalk has been photographed undertaking sea trials in the North Sea for the first time. We have some very cool pictures on our website of the yacht travelling via canal through town to the ocean and making Oldsmere look like a toy village, so I do recommend checking those out. Boardwalk was commissioned by an experienced yachtsman who previously owned a 50-metre Westport, also called Boardwalk, and she features an interior by Halfman Designs, whose principal used to lead the design department at Westport. Boardwalk was, incredibly, the fourth new-build superyacht to be launched by the Dutch builder Fedship in 2020, following 99.95-metre Moonrise, 72.8-metre Podium and 49.65-metre Totally Nuts. Delivery to the owner of Boardwalk is due to take place in 2021.
I just want you can definitely see the family styling between the previous, the 50-metre Westport and the 76.5-metre Fed ship. They are, the styling cues are clear. But just a classic-looking boat. Yeah, I'm sure it'll serve her owner very, very well.
Exactly. Sounds like an owner who knows what he likes. Mm. Finally, Boat International's virtual boat show is back. It kicks off on the 8th of February, which is Monday, so don't miss it.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Virtual boat show is back with some new exhibitors, lots of returning exhibitors and some very, very exciting new exhibitors. We've kind of refreshed the look and feel of the show, so head over to boatinternational.com and you can find the virtual boat show there. It's a great way to look at a lot of boats and experience a lot of exhibitors' products very, very quickly and easily. It's a really good initiative. Meanwhile, on the data front this month, we're going back into the brokerage story of 2020 because we've had some updated figures from last year and they have only improved the picture. But I'm not going to spoil the story. Caroline, what do you got for us?
Well, when we discussed this a few weeks ago, we agreed that the brokerage community had done an incredible job in continuing to sell boats despite a global pandemic. Keeping the number of sales in 2020 at a very respectable level. Well, since that report, some late coming news of 2020 sales has bumped the year-end total up even further. The updated number of sales in 2020 is 409. That's three more boats than were sold in 2019, which is an incredible achievement.
And everyone was pretty happy with 2019. So for 2020, more brokerage boats were sold in 2020. I cannot get my head around that. That is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at the shape of the year, only 61 brokerage sales were made between March and May, which is around half the usual amount. But the final 6 months of 2020 were much stronger than either 2019 or 2018.
And there was some insane number of boats sold in December, 50-odd, I think, across the...
It's around 57. I think it's something like that. There was one. There was only one other month since 2018, which had achieved the same month total. Incredible.
Incredible. Yeah. Amazing.
So when I spoke to Fraser CEO Raphael Solo about this for the podcast a few weeks ago, he suggested that the year's success might be partly explained by brokers doubling down and really communicating with their client base. They also did much more in the way of digital tours. They even sold a few boats via Zoom. He also suggested that some clients who might normally charter made the choice to buy so that they could go on board whenever they wanted because they're not staying in hotels anytime soon. And also so that they could control the procedures on board.
Yeah, there's more and more of these stories of boats being sold sight unseen, which was basically unheard of in pre-COVID times. And the owner of Panthalassa But I was talking to him not long ago, and he was saying he just basically bought it off pictures. He knew the pedigree of the boat. He knew it was a good boat, Norman Foster Interior, very, very quality product. But he didn't step on board and bought the boat, and it's a massive sailing boat. So, yeah, there's been a lot of that lately.
Good. Okay. Well, my colleague Miranda Blaisby has also been speaking to some other brokers. So Richard Lambert, who is head of sales at Burgess, said, "These figures absolutely reflect our experience of the market. We had a reasonable start to the year. It went quiet. And then the last 6 months from July, there was a real uptick, especially the last few months from October over the last quarter, when we saw a significant level of activity." Toby McLaurin, sales director of Ocean Independence, said, "We sold the same amount of yachts in 2019. Our performance in the 24 metre plus range was 22% up on 2019, and our average length went up compared to 2019. In terms of an explanation for the uptick in the second half of the year, Lambert said, "There were probably a number of reasons. The world had opened up a bit. People had the opportunity to inspect boats later in the year. There was a bit of anticipation ahead of the US election. People were looking to purchase before the change of administration. Then the realisation that yachting gives you much more freedom, especially owning a boat as opposed to chartering." In a similar vein, McLaurin said, "We're all slightly tired of being told what to do, and there's no greater freedom than the navigation of the seas." Couldn't agree more. Interestingly, he also noted that the fact the Cannes and Monaco boat shows were cancelled, but the brokerage community still managed to sell so well this last year, made them all look at boat shows in a different way. So we'll see if that leads to any changes in the way that people use boat shows.
I definitely think that point about people searching for freedom is really something we're seeing in the chartering as well. You know, people want to get away from everyone and the boat's just the perfect way to do that. So it'll be interesting to see how that reflects in the charter destination sales, and if we do see more kind of exploratory trips to more isolated sort of island communities and things as a result of this. But great that it's doing so well.
Whenever I kind of see figures like this, I always think, I get frustrated because I kind of think I've got to attribute it to a specific data point, as an exchange rate movement or something like that, or the price of oil or something. But really, it's so much more emotional than that, isn't it? It like you've just identified it there. It's just people wanting to get away, and you know, and the old adage that, you know, if not now, when? You know, if the world's ending by a pandemic, buy a boat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people's ability financially to buy a boat hasn't changed, and that's something that will remain the same. It's their decision to push the button now as opposed to in a year, or whether it was a year ago. Now is the moment people seem to be choosing.
Why wait? So yeah, just a phenomenal performance. So well done to all the brokerage houses out there for getting so many boats sold. Fantastic. Righty, that's it for the news and insight this week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Stay tuned for my interview with Superyacht Captain John Creepy. So, John, let's start with the World Superyacht Award. Well, first of all, congratulations. For everyone listening, John was the captain of Dorothea 3, the boat that won the World Superyacht Voyages Award for an inspirational two-year journey it went on. So, John, congratulations.
Thank you, Stuart. Yeah, you know, you never think you're going to win anything. At least I don't. I met shortly after the Latitude crew won back in, geez, what would that have been, 16, 17?
Yeah, something like that, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and I remember thinking to myself, holy cow, you know, I mean, what they did was really amazing. And we were nominated through Ron Holland, and we went through the application process, which, you know, was fairly extensive in the sense of what the committee wanted for documentation and photos and description and this and that. And never really thought we'd win, to be honest, because that voyage was sort of a, I wouldn't say garden variety, but it's not really off the charts for us as a boat. And, you know, we've been doing that kind of cruising for the last, you know, nearly 20 years in at least some aspect. So it was a surprise, and no, we didn't, we didn't think we had it, but we sure appreciate it.
Well, I remember I was in, I'm not a judge, but I sit with the judges because they're all super yacht owners, and they were really impressed with the extent and the range of the journey, I remember, and particularly the aspect of post one, basically that you did the journey in convoy. There was Dorothea 3, the 45-meter Choili Ron Holland-designed super yacht, and the 63-foot Hatteras that went alongside you. And not towing it, the boat went on its own bottom on the journey, basically covering the same miles as Dorothea 3.
Yeah, that's correct. I joined the program late 2001. And I believe in 2002, we got our first fishing boat, and we started towing, and we used to tow between Alaska and Panama every year. And then Alaska to Panama, into the Caribbean, back to Florida, Bahamas, then Alaska. And the boats over the years changed. And the largest boat that I towed was a 45 Hatteras, which was really 53 feet overall. And with 65,000 pounds. And that went okay, but we got to a point where the fishing side of our program started advancing to a point where the owner was interested in catching more fish, bigger fish, different locations. And it kind of, it required a bigger boat, and the 45 worked, but it didn't tow well. And it just got to a point where one night we were off of Vanuatu, and things went sideways really quickly. And we managed to put it together. But by the time we got into New Caledonia, I had sort of mentally made the decision that my days of towing were over. And so we went back to Hatteras for a boat that that we thought could make it across the oceans, and so that's what we did. And we weren't really, you know, we never really had an itinerary that included cruising the world. We sort of had an itinerary that let's run the boats in tandem and see what we can do. And until we got the boats together, we weren't really sure. We weren't sure what that meant, but it worked.
Yeah, it certainly did. Before we get into the specifics of the trip, why don't we wind the clock back a little bit? So you said you've been involved with the Dorothea program since 2000.
Yeah, it's been about 20 years.
20 years. Okay. So that's a long time with one boat. So where did you start as a captain before Dorothea?
Yeah, feels like yesterday. You know, the program's winding down, but I tell you, it's not really a good thing. It's been a great 20 years, man.
Yeah.
We've done the things that most people just read about. But how did I get started? I grew up in Stuart, Florida, and down the river from where I grew up was a local Hatteras dealer. And like all young guys, I wanted money, and I didn't have a job. And I knew boats. I had helped build some small boats when I was young. And I got a job on the docks washing boats. And as they kind of say, the rest is history. But I, you know, after being employed, I found sport fishing. I found, you know, sort of the network of boat shows. And, you know, I couldn't believe that you could actually make a living, you know, fishing or working on boats. I was supposed to go to school and do all the right things, and here I am.
Instead, you went to sea.
Yeah. And I've had three jobs. I've worked for Hatteras, I worked for myself, and I've worked here. And wow. I'm 37 years old. And it's sort of, as they say, bittersweet. You know, it's a very unique program for a very unique family with a very unique objective. And nobody really wants to see it stop, but eventually all good things have to come to an end.
Yeah. And I think what you mentioned earlier, you said for you were a little bit surprised you won the award, because for Dorothea 3 and you and the owners, the kind of journey you did was, you know, a bit more run of the mill, because you guys are used to serious sea miles and lots of, I think I saw a figure, you did 150,000 miles or something in Dorothea 3. I saw that somewhere. But for most people, what you did is extraordinary. So when you got involved with the program, was that from day one? Was that built into the fabric of it?
No.
No.
No. They built it into me.
Okay.
No, when I started, when I took over, when I joined the program and then ultimately took over for Mark Drulo, who is the chairman of YAG, they were already Globetrotters. And, you know, Mark, he took the original Dorothea, you know, and it's crazy. I mean, you know, you think what we did was nuts. You know, he took a wooden 100-foot boat that had no communication, more or less. He had no facilities for shore power, and you know, literally drove it from Europe through the Red Sea, across the Indian Ocean, through the Maldives, Seychelles, over to Singapore, through Southeast Asia, down to Australia, across the South Pacific, and back to Mexico, and then ultimately to San Diego.
Wow.
And this was 1994 to 1998, 99.
That's because the owners were based in Singapore, around.
Yeah, and then they wanted to go cruise all of those areas. You know, that was pretty complicated too.
Yeah, but yeah.
You know, and back then, I mean, there wasn't, he didn't have what I had. I mean, you know, I had VSAT, I had a lot of advantages that he didn't have. The difference is I had two boats, he had one, you know, so that complicates things. So, but
yeah,
I mean, it's been a program that has pushed the envelope for now. Well, Mark was with the boat for 10 years, so 30-something years. I mean, you know, when this program goes away, this is one of the last great yachtsmen. I mean, this, you know, Steve Green is like, he is not afraid to buy fuel. I can tell you that. He bought a lot of it. He has bought a lot of fuel. And he's brought a lot of good things to a lot of places in the world that wouldn't have gotten it. So it's different in the sense that it's a team effort, you know.
Yeah,
we could have never done it without him, and he couldn't have done it without us. But yeah, it's definitely, it's not like your garden variety boat that goes to the Caribbean, goes to the Med, you know, the crew changes out every 2 to 3 years, and but more or less it operates like a hotel, and there's not a lot of emotion, or it's kind of a job for everyone. This isn't a job.
I can understand the emotional attachment. Absolutely. And he actually, when we spoke to Stephen for a feature at the magazine, he said he kind of maligned that traditional comment that the best two moments in a yacht owner's life is the day you buy it and the day you sell it. He said that wasn't true at all in his experience. He said he would be enormously sad when Dorothea 3, which actually currently for sale, eventually sells. But when did he buy Dorothea 3? How long did he own that particular boat?
July of 11, we bought it. And we took off for Points Unknown November of 11. We were gone for 3 years. And in that three-year span, we did, I think, 40-something countries.
Wow.
We've done 200,000 miles in 70 countries since we've bought the boat.
A lot more than 150,000 then. I was way off.
We've done the South Pacific 5 times. We've done the North Pacific 2 times. We've done the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, Patagonia. We've been, you know, as far west as the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, and I guess about 100-something miles up the Mekong River and Saigon rivers, and we've done some crazy stuff, man.
And it's quite inspirational too, because I mean, she wasn't necessarily built as this rough, tough, all action explorer, was she?
Yeah, we didn't, you know, Ron designed a hell of a boat. We changed some of the systems out, but for the most part, what you see is what you get. It's a single engine, commercially equipped 45 meter motor yacht that's steel hull, fiberglass superstructure, and it's a good boat. We've had a lot of good luck with it. And, you know, it's just like anything else. I mean, you take care of it, it takes care of you.
Yeah.
You know, the one that we were awarded for was a good one. And, but, you know, like I said, it's, I wouldn't say it's garden variety, but, you know, we've done a lot of interesting ones over the years.
Well, why don't we just focus a bit on that particular 2 year journey? So can you just, for everyone listening at home, can you just roughly kind of map it out for us?
Sure. January of 18, both boats left Miami and went to Cancun, Mexico. And this was the first overnight underway voyage. But Post One had enough fuel to get from Miami down to Cancun with two fuel bladders. So that trip went off without a hitch. And we spent a couple weeks there sail fishing. And then we planned on going down to Panama. And this was yet another journey that Post One could do on its own, you know, basically cruising in tandem with Dorothea. And we did not have to refuel. So we got down to Panama. We fished Panama and Costa Rica. And the idea behind getting underway and where we were going to go was that the first item on the to-do list was get to Bermuda. And then ultimately, we've always wanted to go to Azores. And so that's an 1,800-mile trip. And we thought, well, you know, let's figure out this fuel thing. And back 15, 20 years ago, there was Don Tyson from Tyson Chicken. He had a mothership sport fishing operation called Tyson's Pride and Horizons. And the two guys that ran it, I know. And I consulted with them, and their method for refueling didn't really coincide with what we were thinking. But they had cruised quite a bit in tandem, sort of under the radar of a lot of people. But, you know, back then, back in the 90s and whatnot, there really wasn't an outlet for you know, talking about this stuff or really broadcasting it. But so when we were in Panama and Costa Rica, what we started doing was we would cruise with Dorothea and Post One. And on calm days, we would just bring Post One up. We would throw a line with a monkey's fist, and we would throw the monkey's fist onto the bow of Post One. And we would just leave it there, just sort of hanging. And as long as there was no tension on it, the monkey's fist would just sort of sit on the bow. And we thought, well, let's replace it with a fuel line. And so we did, but this was flat calm. And so we rigged up what, you know, what was sort of a first run of, you know, how do you fuel underway? And we started modifying it. But by the time we did this, you know, probably half a dozen times in Panama, we got to the point where we were, you know, offloading 500, 600, 800 gallons of fuel on the Post One. We're like, okay, well, we did it. Fuel went from one boat to another. And so we went through the canal and we did our first underway fueling just north of Jamaica on not the calmest of days, but not the roughest of days. And it went okay. But we needed to modify the procedure a little bit. So the next time we needed to fuel was behind Great Anagua on our way to Bermuda. And we thought, well, you know, we lengthened the fuel line, we made a few changes to it, and yet it worked again. And so long story short is we made it to Bermuda. And you know, it's kind of a precarious situation because you need a cohesive team, you need the boats in sync, and you need weather. And so how did we get from point A to point B? Well, I would say 75% of it, Stuart, is weather. So when we crossed from Bermuda over to Azores, we did it in the Azores high. And that makes for really, really, really good travel weather. So if you look at our itinerary and you look at when we did it with the trade winds. So, and we did it with the current. And so we had the best of the best in terms of weather. And we've never had a schedule. And that's part of our program, you know, either with towing or with a tandem program. You can't have, you know, I've got to be in. There's no I've got to be anywhere. You've got two boats. You've got nine crew. You've got people working outside. You've got people, you know, literally on the bow of a fishing boat, you know, 1,000 miles offshore. So the variable for us is that, you know, a lot of other boats don't have is that we don't have a schedule. If we get there on the 10th, great. That's the day we got there. If we get there on the 20th, that's the day we got there. And you know, that's one of the keys. And that's part of the teamwork, you know, is that the owner has never put, you know, those kinds of requirements on us because it never would have worked. I mean, you can't control the weather. And I don't know how many times he has said that to me because, you know, I'm aware that everyone's got a schedule and, you know, we try to build in enough of a buffer to where, you know, we don't inconvenience them. We've never missed an owner's trip, but, you know, I've never been under some extreme pressure to, you know, try to get from point A to point B in some fashion. I mean, it's enough to get two boats from point A to point B. So you can't throw some crazy timeline in on it.
So that kind of running in tandem, so the Dorothea and the mothership and Post One, the 63-foot Sportfisher up to Bermuda and then across to the Azores, that was kind of like the fine tuning of the refueling at sea process. Because what was the range of Post One?
2.5 days.
Okay, so you know you were refueling at sea a fair bit then.
I think we did it 50 something times.
Wow,
in that journey. So yeah, it's a lot, you know, and you figure it's like an hour and a half to 2 hours each time. So we've got, you know, probably 300 hours of refueling time.
So by the time you got to the Azores, were you pretty confident with your process? You thought we got it down now?
No, I think that we thought that we were going to be okay, but still pretty skeptical. And then, you know, in normal Dorothea fashion, it was, you know, okay, so where do we go from here? And the idea was to follow the blue marlin migration. So it was natural to go to Madeira, then Portugal, then Canary Islands. Then from Canary, we threw in Cape Verde. And then from Cape Verde, we threw in Brazil because I threw in Patagonia. And when the Greens found out about Patagonia, they were all about it. And when when Brazil came up, that was like, you know, because that's sort of the epitome of blue marlin fishing and definitely a bucket list destination in terms of fishing. So, I pitched it to them. They were all about it. And then we had to figure out how to make it work. But the hardest part was Cape Verde down to Rio with the stop in Ascension, which was, I think it was like 4,200 miles. And that was 19 days underway.
Wow. So yeah. Okay. A good few refueling stops then mid ocean on that leg.
Yeah. And that was kind of commingled with a bunch of miscommunication, and there was Ascension didn't have all of the fuel that we had bought, and that was interesting.
Yeah, that's a great story actually, because there's a thrice yearly supply ship, isn't there, from to Ascension that only made it twice that year. Is that right? So the fuel that you were expecting to be there wasn't there when you turned up.
Right. But they offered us a free dockage, free anchorage till next January. Yeah, that was a pretty crazy place. It's kind of like Mars. I mean, it's, you know, you're traveling for like 7 days south from Cape Verde, you know, off the coast of Africa. Then all of a sudden you come up to this mountain that's got no trees on it except for what Darwin planted back, you know, I don't know, how long ago was that? 150 years ago?
I'll ask Google later.
Yeah. So he planted a bunch of bamboo on the top of the mountain, which creates, you know, a mechanical rainforest. I mean, it's ingenious. But literally, they have this, it's like a brown rock. And then on top of it, there's this bamboo forest, which is totally not natural. And they've got their own rain. I mean, he made a rainforest. So, you know, and I'm not saying it's not like the Amazon in terms of raining 600 inches a year, but any fresh water is a good thing. So yeah, we got there and they gave us the bad news, and what was going to be a couple of day sort of resting period, change oil on post one, yada, yada, ended up being like a 10-hour refueling and then get underway again for Rio.
So you could just get enough fuel to get you to Rio from Ascension then?
Yeah, I think we loaded like 5,000 gallons, something like that, 20,000 liters or whatnot. And then I think we ended up getting into Rio with maybe 20%, something like that.
That's not too bad.
Right. But, you know, the issue was is that the last 3 days we were stopping. We were stopping to wait for weather, and we knew that the weather was going to catch us the closer we got to the Brazilian coastline. And if we would have waited the 3 days, we would have burnt that extra 20% sitting on generators and stabilizers and post one running and all of this. So we would have had almost zero. So, which made it complicated in the sense that we needed the capability of being able to refuel in conditions that we had never seen. Mm. The last day that we refueled, it was 30 knots of wind and probably 8 to 10 foot seas. And we loaded up 1,000 gallons of fuel on the post one. And that was when we were really dialed in. That's when we figured it out. And that's, you know, that's when we knew that we could go anywhere.
But that took two Atlantic crossings, basically, to get to that skill level, effectively, of refueling while underway.
Yeah, that's how long it takes. It's not easy. I mean, you know, you're bringing two boats together, you know, and they're sitting, you know, literally 10 meters apart in conditions that are just ever changing. And you're pumping at 20 gallons a minute. I mean, it's not like you've got a fire hose of fuel going back. Yeah, it's not easy.
Were there any kind of dangerous or dodgy moments, or any moments where you thought, oh, this could go very, very wrong very, very quickly?
There was an episode early on where Post One sort of slid down sea and got within maybe 10 feet of the transom of Dorothea. And I was on the swim platform, and I thought that it was just going to come and pick me up off the swim platform and throw me in the ocean. But yeah, that was actually we never lost a fuel line. We, you know, no one ever got hurt, you know, but we started slow with sort of incremental steps. And I got a call 2 days ago from a guy that had seen some of our videos, and he literally had like a 5-minute call with me. And I sort of alluded to the fact that, you know, hey, maybe we should like have a cup of coffee and talk about this. And he said, oh, you know, I've seen your videos and I just wanted to know, you know, what kind of fuel hose you used. And I said, well, this is it. And he's like, okay, well, I should be fine. I
was like, you should have said, well, it's going to take you two Atlantic crossings to figure this out.
You know, who knows? Maybe he'll get it figured out by the time he gets to the Bahamas. But, you know, I asked him a couple questions and he was like, I don't know. But it can't be that hard. And I was like, ah. I was like, I don't know. I thought it was pretty hard.
So you got to. It was interesting, actually. So you kind of went across the Atlantic, but you didn't go into the Med. You kind of stayed outside, but Portugal, Canaries, Cape Verde, Ascension, back to South America, and then you went. Did you go around the bottom?
Yeah,
and into the Pacific.
Yeah, we did. We shipped Post One from Rio over to Panama, and then Dorothea took off from Rio, went down the coast of Argentina into. The Straits of Magellan to Punta Arenas, and then from Punta Arenas down to Puerto Williams in southern Chile. And Post One would have never made it through there. Never. That's just a gnarly area of the world. We got to the point where when it was blowing 50 that we thought, Jesus, really not too bad out. Because when it's windy there, it's like 70. I mean, it's the windiest place on earth. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And we've been as far north as, the Kuril Islands off of Siberia and southern Russia and the Aleutians and the Gulf of Alaska. But it is relentless down there. I mean, it is just relentless. I mean,
are they the wildest seas you kind of encountered on this journey?
Not really wild seas, but I guess coming back from Chile, up to Galapagos, we were going with it, but we were going with it in probably like 10 to 12 footers. And it was, literally days on end, like gnarly, following quartering seas. And, thank God, you're going north, but it's all about the voyage planning and being able to predict in at least a general way, what are the trends. And that's the key to this voyage, was that, it looks, sort of intimidating in some senses because of the amount of distance, but, the secret is that, and I don't know how many people have clued into it, is that we went downwind, down sea for 45,000 miles. And that was part of the design. That's how we did it. I mean, the reason that we shipped Post One back from Australia was that it's against the trades. It's against the Southeast trades that come, off the coast of South America. Those Southeast trades blow all the way to Australia. And it's a 6-foot to 7-foot sea, for the most part, the entire way, the entire 8,000 miles across the South Pacific. But guess what? If you're going west, you're going with it.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. And that's how we've done all of our trips, is that we don't go against the grain, because you just can't. Not when you're towing or running in tandem. I mean, I've seen a lot of boats that, come out of Panama and head for Patagonia. And I'm thinking to myself, holy cow. I mean, they get south of Ecuador, they are in for an ass whooping. I mean, and there's like 2,000 miles of, and that's the southeasterly, trades. And they got to make it through the horse latitudes, and they're getting down into the roaring 40s. And, we went with all that stuff. And that's how we made it work. And I talked to some of those boats, and they had some rough days, man. It's rough weeks.
Yeah, weeks.
It's tough. That's a tough way of getting down there. And a lot of people do it that way. And yeah, so we didn't.
What was it like going around Cape Horn? I've always romanticized that journey. All the pictures I've seen, it's mostly shattered in fog or cloud or something, so very few people.
Yeah, we never made it around it.
Okay.
It was too rough and it's one of those things, I guess. Maybe we should have, but the days that we had the opportunity to, it was gnarly. It just wasn't worth it. I mean, we were within 50 miles of it, but to go out into 30-foot seas, to go around a rock, to come back in, I guess we'll save that for another time. I don't know. Yeah.
So then you kind of picked back up, you met Post One in Panama and then across the Galapagos, then into the deepest Pacific. And Post One again on her own bottom in the Pacific Ocean.
That's correct. Yeah. So when we were about 2 days, 3 days out of Galapagos, Post One departed from Panama, met us in Galapagos. Both boats reunited, and then shortly thereafter, we took off for Papeete. Initially, Nukuheva in the French Marquesas, which is one of our favorite destinations.
And what's that? That's probably 20 days at sea, 18, 20 days or something like that between Galapagos and Marquesas?
That was a little less than that, about 14, 15, okay. Something like that. It's about 3,200 miles. And that was, another 10 refueling, something like that. And, once we got to Galapagos, we were pretty well convinced we can go anywhere. And so we did.
The kind of the ultimate for this particular journey, where did it all end up? You kind of weaved your way across the Pacific down to...
October 15th, more or less, we pulled into Cairns, Australia and the Great Barrier Reef. Mission complete. And
And were the Greens kind of flying in and out, or were they on passage with you a lot of the way?
No, they don't do passages for the most part. We fished the Marquesas, the Tuamotos, Tonga, Vanuatu, and Cairns, Australia.
If anyone listening to this, any skippers listening to this, or owners listening to this, thinking, oh, that's it, I can take on something like that. What would be your advice to them?
Look, in 1967, right, we put a guy on the moon. So anything is possible. I just think that, you have to look at all the different aspects. I sort of go into things thinking that, how hard is it going to be and what do we need to, really focus on? Is this doable? Yeah, I think... The difference that I see in the industry is I love to fish, and both boats have to be synchronized. And so I think the thing that is you have to think about is that your 150-foot boat has the constraints of a 60-foot boat. Your crew has to be synchronized. Your engineer has to want to, refuel. Your chief officer has to want to be able to put together a safety plan, for such. You've got to have a sport fishing captain that is wanting to do this. You've got to have, and how many of these, and I don't want to be negative. I'm not being negative, but sort of realistic is that, how many of these people are, sort of wanting to get to the dock, to get to their buddies on, this boat or that boat. And you can't have that. You can't have, the expectation and the want and the need of being somewhere else to do something else. You've got to be in the moment and want, and all parties have to want to do this. It can't be the fishing boat is sort of a nuisance to the big yacht, because the yacht is the, you're the mothership. You're supplying the food, the laundry, the fuel, the entertainment, in the sense of what's going on in the world. Because these guys are just hanging on for dear life back there for days at a time. And it's a big what I'm saying is that it's a sacrifice for everybody involved. And I think the unique part about our program is that you've got 9 people that are all in it for the same thing. Like, we're going to go do this. And I don't typically see that in a lot of your boats that are tied up to a dock in Fort Lauderdale. I think that you've got a 15-person crew and there's 15 different ideas as to why they're there.
Yeah. It can't happen very often that there is such alignment in a crew. But that's right. Probably because I'm guessing people have been like you've been with the program for 20 years, so that helps a lot in kind of
how many people join yachting for the, you know, for the genuine interest of being in the ocean for 200 days a year?
Not too many.
So there you go. And I think it's the most magical place on earth. Maybe aside from Jackson on a day that's got snow. But, you know, yeah, I mean, if so is, that's why I think it's sort of unrealistic, because you've got, you know, sort of at the top of the heap here, you've got Steve Green that all he wants to do is be on his boat fishing and some, you know, crazy off the beaten path destination. And then you've got nine people that support him.
Yeah.
And I've worked for 20 years and I'm not sure that I've ever put in a day of work.
That's nice. That's a nice thing to be able to say.
Yeah. So can you rebuild that and duplicate it on, you know, Motor Yacht XYZ? I guess you can, but I haven't seen it yet. Okay. I haven't. Yeah. So
before I let you go, John, I just wanted to mention just quickly the philanthropy. Obviously, the Greens were committed to obviously doing good as they went. So can you tell us a bit about how what role that played in your journey and what it meant for the communities you encountered?
It means a lot. They never pushed it on us, but they gave us the boat to use so that we could use it. You know, some of our past missions were, we did water bottle and water filtration systems for the Lao group in Fiji after Hurricane Wilson decimated, you know, these communities that were sort of brushed aside by the Fijian government because they're sort of, I don't want to say outcast, but they're like, they're part of Fiji, but they're way the hell out in the middle of nowhere. So we did a water filtration and supply drive for them. We did hurricane relief efforts for the Turks and Caicos on our way back to the shipyard in 2000. And I think it was 17 when Hurricane Maria destroyed the Turks and Caicos. It came up from Puerto Rico, destroyed Puerto Rico. And we did that in conjunction with Yacht Aid Global. And then in 2018, we did the Marlin mission, which was a pledged base fundraiser where we raised, I think, you know, just less than 30 grand on Blue Marlin that we released. People pledged money per Marlin that we caught. And, you know, here's the reality. The reality is that you've got, you know, some big boats that pull into port XYZ. They buy fuel, they buy food, but you've also got this community of fishermen and poverty stricken populations that never really see any of the money that you spend in any of these small towns. And then you've got our operation that comes in with a big boat and a big fishing boat. And, you know, we're running generators, we're making water, we're doing this, we're doing that. And is the destination any better off for us having been there? Well, the answer is no. I mean, there's an element of pollution. There's an element of, you know, of us going out and catching their fish. And it doesn't seem right to me. You know, I don't have an issue with it in Azores that, you know, it's a you know, basically a wealthy European community and they don't care. But when you pull into Cape Verde, I think it's only responsible, you know, you pull in there with $30 million worth of boats. You need to give something back to somebody. So we did. So we split the money that we raised between Cape Verde and Brazil, and specifically Rio. And in Cape Verde, we did some research. We found two schools that were in need of a lot of help, and one orphanage. And you know, one of the things that we did was, is I think we took 20 something kids to an optometrist. because they had varying issues with eyesight. And we were able to get them all glasses. And we had 9, 11, 14-year-old kids that put on a pair of glasses, and that was the first time they had seen a leaf. They thought a bush was just this like green blob. They had never seen grass before. And we gave the schools food for X amount of months. And I think we hired a computer teacher for 6 months. And we brought in some computers and, you know, just, it really wasn't that hard. I mean, it just takes some effort. In Rio, we did a similar thing. And, you know, the things that we take for granted is just, it's just mind boggling. The kids in Rio, you know, I asked the representative that we had there on the ground. I said, well, you know, how often do kids come to school? And they're like, well, you know, it just depends. And I said, well, depends on what? Because I'm thinking it depends on, you know, laziness, or are they at the beach? You know, maybe they don't want to go to school. He's like, well, no. He goes, it depends on the shootings. And I'm like, what do you mean the shootings? He said, well, they have an app on their phone, and it shows them where the drug dealers are shooting people in the streets. And if it's near their house or on their way to school, they can't leave. Can you imagine, like, you know, you're a 9-year-old kid and you can't go to school because you're afraid of being, you know, taken fire from a, you know, a gang of drug dealers. This is reality for, and this isn't some city, you know, in the backwoods of Brazil, somewhere in the jungle. This is Rio. You know, you could spend $800 a night at the Copacabana Hotel, and a mile away, 9-year-old kids have to look at their phone to figure out whether or not they can make it to swim camp and whether or not they're going to make it home that night. And so we roll in, and if you don't do something for some of these people, then I just think it's somewhat irresponsible.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think
I mean, you know, and you know, is this on the level of what Steve and Dorothea Green do? No. I mean, they've made schools and universities, and the things that he's done is off the charts. He won't even tell you about them. But I've heard a few stories here and there and blow you away, but it's better than nothing, you know, and $30,000 is not going to change the world. But, you know, imagine if every boat or every other boat just did something, that, you know, it'd be huge. You know, think about how the yachting community would change. Just think about the view of wealthy people in general would change. People would see it as a mercy ship pulling in, you know, and how does it affect the spreadsheet at the end of the year for, you know, a 70 meter boat? I mean, give me a break. It's like nothing. I mean,
not even the wine budget, you know, it's
not the wine budget for a 1 week trip.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, I think you're right. And, you know, we're kind of battling this, the image problem of yachting.
It's the image as to which these aren't like hard things to do. It's not like, this isn't refueling at sea, for crying out loud. This is just going to the dollar store with $500 and walking out with 3 bags, and you walk off the back of your boat and just hand it to somebody and say, have a nice day. How hard is that?
Not hard at all.
Yeah.
Well, John, I hope many more boats follow in Dorothea and your examples. That many are, but many more could be. So thank you very much for sharing that story. Inspirational and an example to set as well. Thank you very much. Enjoy your skiing. I hope you get a good day today.
All right, Stuart. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.